You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by Social Brand Forum 2016. This industry-leading digital marketing experience brings the best and brightest thought leaders like Jay Baer, Jenny Dietrich, and Joe Polizzi to the heart of the heartland for 2 days of insightful keynotes and tactical how-tos. Get the best rate when you register using promo code ONBRAND at socialbrandforum.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Sarah Green Carmichael. Sarah is a senior editor at Harvard Business Review. She also hosts their podcast, the HBR IdeaCast, which has been nominated for 2 National Magazine Awards under her tenure. Connect with her on Twitter at SK Green. Sarah, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Leave it to a fellow podcaster to have a mercifully short bio that I don't trip over, that I don't have to do that awkward. Okay, let me stop. I'm gonna do that again. Go into all of that. But as that is concise, how did you come to where I find you today?
Well, so I've been at HBR for about 10 years now, which is part of the reason my bio is so short. I haven't moved around all that much. But prior to joining HBR, I spent a couple of years as a political op-ed researcher for a syndicated columnist. And then I spent about 5 years as a sports writer before realizing that my interests in sort of, on the one hand, with my interest in politics, I was interested in shaping the world, having an impact on the world, improving the world, a lot of people are right out of college. But also with my interest in sports, I was really interested in sort of team dynamics and how people put teams together and what made some teams better than others, even when they had smaller budgets. And I realized that these things really were leading me to an interest in management. And so about 10 years ago, I made the leap to join HBR, and I've been there ever since.
I love that story. That's so interesting. It was another nice thing about that short bio is it gave me the opportunity to ask that because yours is a great story that kind of proves out, I think you end up where you're supposed to. And I think sometimes we kind of sweat over, what am I doing here? How do I get there? And I don't know where the there is. But when you tell it like that, it sounds like you ended up exactly where you're supposed to.
Well, it's funny. I've heard people say there's sort of 2 ways you can tell your life story. One is I've ended up in a place I never would have anticipated. And the other is, I think I've ended up, everything I've done in the past has led me to where I am today. And I think you can take the same set of facts and they're both true.
That's well said there. So on the Boston, I would presume you are Boston based.
Yes.
With your work at HBR, and I would assume on the sports team side of things, you're probably spoken for there. Are you?
Oh, yeah, strongly spoken for. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Strongly would be the other given because I don't think anybody's in that neck of the woods mildly committed.
Yes, it's funny. I read. I'm mostly a baseball fan, but we are obviously Patriots fans as well in this part of the world, and I remember reading some BuzzFeed article right before Thanksgiving that was saying, one safe topic of conversation is how much everyone hates the Patriots. Everyone will agree on this. And I was like, not if you have people from New England at your kitchen table.
Tenuous at best there. Well, it's interesting. This is my somewhat clunky but announced segue to the world of branding because, I like that you talk about the you know, the management side of you know, your sports interests. But I also think, as you've touched on with that article, that we do have very emotional connections too with our brands, and especially our sports brands as well. I mean, I think that you take the kind of the raw materials everyone has to work with, and you know, as you said, some have more money, more or less money. Mm-hmm. But I think that kind of brand DNA piece is a big part of that as well, too.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, and it's funny, sports is one of those areas where it's almost, you know, we take our sports fairly seriously in New England, but at the same time, it's one of those areas where it's sort of safe to surface some of these emotional and irrational aspects to brand love, because they're really just a bunch of dudes hitting a ball around. And, you know, so it's not like lives are on the line here, you know, for the most part. So I think it's one of those areas where you can sort of see how attached people get to an idea or a concept, and in some cases even a logo, and really see that it's really more about emotions and meaning and something else other than the objective, like, we love those actual red socks. Like, no one actually probably cares about the socks, you know, something else.
Well, it's about a month ago we had on the chief marketing officer of the Minnesota Vikings. Mm. And, you know, he's overseen a couple of logo changes, and he said it's a very big deal. You know, your average run-of-the-mill toilet paper brand does not have people with their logo tattooed, you know, on their body in a permanent manner. I guess any tattoo would be. Well, I guess not all tattoos, but would be in a permanent manner. But it's an escalated level of commitment, to say the least.
Yes, I think that is true. Although I will also say that, you know, I'm reminded of the story from a couple years ago when Tropicana totally changed their the look of their orange juice container, and no one could find it on the shelves because it looks so different that people couldn't find it, and sales suddenly took a nosedive. So every now and then you do see that even in a, you know, sort of category that people maybe don't get as excited about as football, you know, orange juice, there can be some pretty big impacts to changing your brand.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. And I, you sound not unlike an HBR case study, which I also, I'm thinking of, you know, all of the different ways that I interact with the Harvard brand. And I'm also an educator here at the University of Iowa. So I was just actually selecting some new case studies on topics not unlike that Tropicana story of what happens when, or some things that go into, you know, some of those brand shifts as well. So in thinking of where you are, I mean, you are, you know, there are so many kind of tentacles to the Harvard brand. So how do you find what's your interaction with the brand at Harvard?
Yes, our tentacles. I like that term.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds like a negative, like Hydra. There, I mean it less so, but it is vast, to say the least.
A friendly octopus. So yes, it is a vast brand. And I think it's something that, you know, obviously, like any strong brand, has enormous benefits. At the same time, there are sometimes when I'm reminded that people outside the Harvard brand may see us differently than we see ourselves. And of course, you know, you think about how different Harvard is, how sprawling it is. I mean, from the medical school to the dental school to the law school, the school of forestry, you know, like they're, you know, to the business school. And, you know, every now and then, you know, you'll get a comment or something from someone that's like, oh, that's right, we are all the same thing, sort of, you know. So I would say, you know, where we sit at HBR is we are an independent publication that has ties to the business school, and we help support the business school. We pay a dividend to them every year. So, you know, that puts us in a kind of a different position than a lot of other media companies. But it also means that, you know, we do have some Harvard connection, but we're not supported by the university, which a lot of people often think that we are.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting relationship from the brand point of view as well, because you are the Harvard brand. I mean, because it's interesting, because I think when you say it like that, it sort of makes sense, but it still kind of keeps tying it in a knot, because you are the Harvard brand, and that is such a big part of who you are, and I would think what the publication and its brand stands for. And yet the very point that you're talking about, and probably hence the confusion that may exist for a lot of folks, is that you're also not the Harvard brand, not Harvard.
Right.
Not the business school.
Not the business school and not the Faculty of Arts and Sciences.
Right.
It's funny, you know, this was brought home to me actually during the last election cycle when we had published something, and I can't remember anymore what the article was, but it was some kind of analysis of presidential candidates and leadership. And we said something about Obama. I can't remember. But it may have been about his healthcare proposal. I can't quite pull it up. But, you know, we got a comment, a scathing comment on the website that said, this is what I would expect from Harvard since Obama went to Harvard, you know, law school, and you guys are also Harvard. You're obviously on his side. And I just thought, oh, yeah, that's right. I totally forgot. You know, he had gone to Harvard Law, and that to other people, this might seem like a conflict of interest. So I think that's more what I meant when I was kind of like, we don't, you know, always see ourselves within this brand as kind of monolithically as I think maybe we seem sometimes to the outside world. But I do think that obviously Harvard is a tremendous, tremendous brand. I mean, standing for, you know, sort of excellence and truth. I mean, Veritas being the university's motto and having really high standards. So, you know, that's obviously a really good thing for us.
I want to come back to Harvard as a tremendous brand in a moment, and also your friendly octopus. And you can feel free to go ahead and use that idea that you developed here on the On Brand podcast to create the actual spokes character of Harvard, Harvard the Friendly Octopus. I won't take it personally. You have the rights to everything that you create here on the On Brand podcast, but I can see it, and I think it would be a wonderful red octopus, big smiling octopus.
Crimson octopus.
Yes.
Yeah.
See, again, tremendous brand. But you said something else on the political stuff that was kind of made me think of something else topically. I was also have political interests and was watching the most recent debate last night, and something similar happened on the Republican side of things, you know, kind of invoking the New York Times and something there. And it's interesting, these institutional brands, that different pieces of them, you know, in that case, literally opinion pieces within them, you know, have opinions, but they kind of get kind of they can become these specters for use on either side. It's an interesting role that, you know, your brand plays when that's developed, when you live that brand, but then when it can kind of become something that someone else can kind of wield on their own, and not necessarily in a truthful way, but in kind of a another party's perception of the truth.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up the New York Times, because I also have a kind of interesting relationship with my relationship with the brand of New York Times, because I think, you know, it's probably very different than what the what was being said in the debate last night. But I think, you know, for me, I hold the Times to very high standards because they are the New York Times, you know, and they're the paper of record. They're the paper I read the most. And so when I read something in there that I think is sort of not up to their usual standard of reporting, I get very emotional about it. And I think our readers often have the same reaction with us. And I think on balance, that's a really good thing, because what it does is it keeps us honest. And, you know, if we're ever on the fence about publishing something, we can sort of cast into the future and say, is this the kind of thing that our readers would really expect? You know, is this the kind of thing that actually might disappoint them, or sort of lead them to question whether we've lost our way? So that can be, and sometimes, you know, as you're just doing your day-to-day job, we're probably all tempted sometimes to cut a corner, but it's the kind of thing that really keeps us honest.
Well, you know, that's a good point too, that there's more similarities there than I'd think of, because even the Harvard brand, even regardless of your relationship, but you're a part of the Harvard brand. And it's interesting when you have a brand that is big enough, like the New York Times, like Harvard, that is really a bigger part of kind of the cultural zeitgeist out there and everything that that entails. It means people have very close relationships with it, as you do with the Times, as other people do with Harvard. But then it can also kind of, it becomes this thing. I mean, in many cases, that's, you know, one of the biggest lessons of branding is that if you're doing it right, it is, it does graduate to something beyond, you know, your total control. But that's a tricky proposition, especially when it comes to the management of that tremendous asset.
Oh, completely. I mean, I think that's one of the most interesting challenges is when there is such a strong brand and you don't have total control over it. How do you evolve it and change it over time? Because you have to. Every company has to evolve. But in a way that is true to the roots of the brand, true to what people expect of the brand. In a way, this goes back to what you were saying about the CMO of the Vikings. You know, you have to evolve. You have to change. But at the same time, you know, you have to keep what really matters most to you.
So what kind of, you know, even with you kind of being, with HBR being kind of a different chapter of the Harvard brand, but what kind of conversations happen about, I mean, because you're also, you know, in addition to being a vast brand, you've been around for a little while, the Harvard brand has.
Yes. the Harvard brand has been around for, you know, since I think the 17th century, yeah. And HBR has been around about 94 years right now, I think. I think we're up to 94, 95, something like that. So what kind of conversations do we have about our brand? Is that what
the... Yeah, the, yeah. I mean, how does, you know, just, you know, I mean, the Vikings have been around significantly less time, and it's even hard for them. So what does... Are there conversations around that evolution and what that should be? What's the right amount of kind of the, you know, literally resting on the laurels of that versus how does a brand that rooted in such rich history continue to evolve?
Well, I think one of the things that we are lucky to have really is that as being part of a university, you know, as you know, gives you tremendous license to explore and innovate and do new research and try new things. And in fact, that is your mandate. You know, I think if you're an educational institution, you can't rest on your laurels. So I think maybe at other companies where there's sort of more of a for-profit mission or, you know, there's, maybe more focus on sort of the, I guess, the needs of the private market, you know, as opposed to like a mission-driven organization. Maybe their conversations are different. I don't know. But I think for us, being part of that university really helps us in focus on the future and the brand sort of almost in a way, you know, evolves itself. Although there are people who make a lot more money than me who are paid to think about that in I'm sure a much more planful way.
Yeah, yeah. So are there heavy word, but are there mandates that come down on what one can and can't do with the Harvard brand, even for really brand extensions like HBR?
I wouldn't say that there are necessarily mandates, but I do think, I mean, one of the sort of flip sides of we've been talking mostly about the customer facing aspects of the brand, but the sort of flip side of that is right. The impact is on the employees. Mm-hmm. And having a strong brand is, I think, also a way to have a really engaged workforce and you end up attracting people, with the strength of your brand. I mean, there's a reason that Google is every college grad sort of top place to work. It's not just that they want to work on internet search, you know, it's that they are driverless cars or whatever they're doing now. It's that they're attracted to that brand because the brand means, you know, excellence and innovation and stuff like that. So, I think the people who ended up being attracted to working at a place like Harvard, similarly, you know, feel like stewards or custodians of this brand, and, you know, are interested in the educational mission of what we do. And so I think that becomes a very sort of strong way to build an organizational culture as well.
Well, and I think that's such a big thing, you know, we you know, whether it's, you know, being a steward or a custodian of a brand. I mean, when your people are a part of, as opposed to a place where they're going to punch a clock and work a job, as opposed to I am a member of a brand. I think that that's it's a tricky, you know, lever to throw. And it's not a lever you can throw, but if you can engineer an organization, a brand like that, you've done some powerful work.
Yeah, well, you know, and it also, I mean, if I'm honest, there are sort of ego gratifying elements to it as well. You know, I mean, you get to tell someone at the end of the day, you work for Harvard, and that makes you feel warm and fuzzy on the inside. So, you know, obviously, you know, it's sort of, there's like the noble things about it. And then there's the parts of it that, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you just kind of are like, yeah, it's a little bit of an ego boost. Makes me feel good about myself.
Well, I mean, that makes me think of another, you know, it sounds kind of somewhat cliche to say of living the brand. But is that something that that you find yourself doing? And if so, what does that mean?
Oh, wow. That's a big question.
Oh, yeah.
I think that, you know, I don't know how I would answer that in response to myself quite exactly. I may not be leading the sort of self-examined life to really fully be able to answer that. But I do think that people do that. I think often if you talk to people who are, for instance, members of the U.S. military or you know, they will tell you like their answers really come across that way. Like they are, you know, not just punching a time clock, you know, they're doing it for some deeper reason that taps into their personal identity. And I do think that there is hunger now more than there was 10 or 20 years ago for people to do work that they do find meaningful in that way. A lot of the articles that cross my desk, both, at the sort of organizational level and at the individual level are all about sort of creating that sense of meaning for employees or finding that sense of meaning in your own career. So I think that there really is a hunger among people and managers of people to somehow figure out a way to make work more meaningful.
So in thinking of your work and Harvard, the friendly octopus with his many tentacles, you know, I think about HBR and you think about you know, the publication, you think about, you know, all of the other platforms, the other touch points that the brand is expanding to. And I also think about your work, speaking as a listener, on the customer facing side of the Harvard brand as well on the IdeaCast, you know, talk a bit about how kind of the publication brand has evolved and found new places to continue to connect with those that are consuming what the brand has to offer.
Yeah, so I think our evolution over the last 10 years or so has been really remarkable. I think if you look at a copy of, first of all, the print magazine from 10 years ago, it would probably be mostly black and white, and it would have the table of contents on the cover, and it would be a selection of very long articles that were mostly text-based, maybe with some exhibits. And I think really we have evolved that to be, and I mean, everything's super high quality, but just a lot to ask people to sort of, busy executives to sort of get through. And I think what we've tried to do over, you know, the past 10 or 15 years is keep the level of rigor that we have, but make it a little bit more attuned to the way people consume content now, a little bit more attuned to people's schedules. So, for instance, I think the podcast is a great example. You know, if you are finding that you are stuck in the car commuting a lot, or you're trying to squeeze in a 20-minute run into your overcrowded schedule, you know, we have the podcast as something that hopefully people can listen to on the go. And hopefully they find time to read the 3,000 or 5,000 word article as well. But, you know, if you don't, at least you have that much. And I think that so while the print publication has evolved to be much sort of more colorful and more, you know, sort of more lively, we also on the digital side have just done, I mean, I'm not like if you went to our website 10 years ago, you would maybe have found like one, like the magazine, the stuff that was in the magazine, you know, maybe, and like some, like one blog post. I mean, we've come so far, and today our website is so far ahead of not only where we were then, obviously, but I think a lot of other management websites now. So we've really gone from being a laggard, I think, to being a front runner.
I'd almost forgotten about, you know, kind of what it used to look like too, the publication. And that is a very big change. And I have to imagine that that was a pretty big leap. I have to think that as you talk about the Harvard brand and what it stands for, that were, you know, I have to imagine maybe there wasn't, that there was that pushback of, we're catering too much to the info snacking culture. We are, you know, moving away, you know, this, it won't have the same rigor or something.
Well, it is interesting you mention that, because I do think in the beginning we wondered if people online would want to read the same kind of thing that they read in print, and maybe the online stuff would have to be shorter or more bullet pointy, or, you know, somehow involve a cat video or, you know,
right,
whatever.
Right.
But I think what we found is that our readers, you know, they have different behaviors, but they're the same basic type of person in both places. And so now I think we, along with a lot of other websites, have realized that people will read really long articles on their phones, for instance. People will read things that really force them to slow down and think carefully. And, you know, the people relish that. People like that. People will make time in their schedules for really high quality content that asks something of them. You know, it's not just all sort of lean back and snack away on your cat video. So, I think initially we wondered if maybe there would be a difference, but we've been really pleased to discover that actually that quality content brings in quality readers.
Well, and it's tricky when your business is quality content. Anytime you expand and alter that platform, you know, there's a concern that you put quality, you jeopardize that, you change that. And I ask that question, too, as someone that you have a remarkably consistent brand voice, even if every article does not sound the same, the overall, the global effect, which I think is something else I'd like to talk about. Regardless of what form that takes, whether it is the printed magazine, whether it is an article on the website, the podcast, you know, it all is of the same, it's all cut from the same cloth.
Well, that's kind of reassuring to hear. I think what we try to do is we try to focus on the intersection of new management thinking and new and rigorous research with what is practical. So I think, you know, there are not a lot of publications that will sort of try to combine those things. I think you have places that are either really practical, but it's not exactly clear, you know, what research or, you know, what it's based on, or you have places that are really into new thinking in research, but never try to actually help you apply it. And I think because we sit at the intersection of both, that kind of makes everything we do sound a little bit similar, whether it's, you know, strategy or managing your time or, you know, whoever the author is.
Well, and as you see more and more brands and businesses working to co-create content with their community, I think you see that struggle of consistency, of brand voice. And in a lot of ways, I mean, that's one in being a publication with, you know, many authors. I think that's one way you've kind of been ahead of the curve there, because some of those consistent publication things that many other organizations that are now creating content are struggling with, that's something that you have your arms around in a much more grounded way.
Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned sort of the content marketing revolution. And I will use the word content. I will also like it noted for the record that I don't really like the word content, because I like to, I mean, each format is so different, but for this, you know, for the sake of argument, the sake of ease, we'll just refer to them all as content. But I think the real difference between a publication like HBR and the marketers who are trying to create content marketing, I think that my impression is that marketers and organizations don't have the independence to really do content, you know, the organizations that really get it give their marketers that independence that they need to make great content. Because part of the reason that, you know, publishers are creating good content is not just like guidelines and brand voice and stuff. It's like that we can actually kill something that's not working out, or we can say, we think this is actually a boring idea and we shouldn't work on it anymore. And I think marketers and companies are often beholden to senior executives who have sort of a vision, or is it, oh yes, we have to use this ridiculous term we've coined, or, you know, and I think for companies to really get better at it, they're going to have to give their marketers a much more independence.
That is a great point. And I love, you know, I always, it's for me and my business, an everyday term content, but it's also not one of my favorites. In fact, when I speak, and I'm addressing content, I have a slide with the awful dictionary definition of content, you know, receptacle that you put stuff in. It's incredibly sterile. And I think to your point, it could be so much more, but I think it struggles to do so, like you said, with the independence of that. So that's why, you know, as every brand is struggling to be in the, lack of a better word, content business, when you're a content brand from the get-go, as HBR is, you have a leg up in a world now overwhelmed by all of the air quote content.
Well, yeah, and I think it is a world where suddenly brand starts to matter a lot more. I think in the early days of the internet, we were kind of like, oh, 1,000 flowers will bloom and the best content will rise to the top. Yeah. And, you know, what we've actually seen is that in a room where everyone is shouting, you know, how do you decide who to listen to? And I think that is where a brand can really help. It becomes more important, not less.
Well, you know, it's interesting because on one of our first shows, we had Andrew Davis, who wrote a book called Brandscaping, and one of the terms he kind of tossed out there that I spent a lot of time thinking about is, I think, kind of summarizing this distinction that you've made of kind of being a content brand as opposed to creating branded content. Mm-hmm. And I think that same struggle of, oh, we have to use these words, it has to go in there because of all of this organizational weight and baggage that the content can't get out from under. I think that's one of the things that can sometimes suck about branded content versus having created a fully realized content brand.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's also interesting to see how much of branded content or content that brands are creating now is also driven by data. It seems like that's a way that people are really trying to differentiate themselves, and there can be enormous, enormous gains to be had from that. But I'm also seeing increasingly, as more companies sort of rush in to try to do that, you end up with kind of a sort of slipshod methodology. Like, I can say this word, methodology.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Midway through, you thought you couldn't. Yeah. You had a crisis of confidence.
I had a crisis of confidence. but yes, so I think that you know, it's something that, it's not easy to do. And especially when you have kind of strictures that you're operating under. So I have to sort of tip my hat to the people who are pulling it off.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, I mean, that's the other scary thing when everybody's in the content business, everybody's in the data business. And you said it earlier that, you know, I think we told ourselves that the cream would rise to the top, and, you know, we see, you know, old content resurfacing. We see less than rigorous data out there. And I also think, to come full circle, that is where, you know, brands are going to matter, where it, you know, if it is coming from the Harvard brand, from hopefully the New York Times brand, it's going to mean something, and that's where that equity is going to pay off.
I hope so. I mean, there's one. Have you seen the movie Spotlight?
Yes, love it.
So it was a great film. Obviously, as a journalist, I am like mandated to enjoy that film. But I did enjoy it. And there's a great scene in there where they sort of give a hat tip to the Boston Phoenix, who first reported the story of abuse of children by priests. But there's a, one of the journalists says, like, yeah, and who read it in the Phoenix? You know, it's not until the Boston Globe comes and does a big story on it that it really catapulted into the national consciousness. And, you know, with all due respect to the dear departed Phoenix, I think they're right. You know, in a way, when a company like the New York Times, the Boston Globe sort of trains its lens on something, it gets a higher visibility, and then you can really have an impact.
Well, and it's actually to go down a on a spotlight jag here, but I love that conversation. Interesting in thinking of a publication, an institutional brand too, because they made that point. But then they also, I think, seeing the journalists in the story, the stakeholders, the stewards of the brand, also realizing that where were they earlier right. on in all of that too, and kind of understanding some of that mission there. I think that was let's just knock off the podcast and we'll go see Spotlight again.
Go watch it again with
Tom. Yeah. I'm the dork that I keep that soundtrack among many up in my Spotify while I'm working and need music without words.
Yes.
So as we start to wrap up and we have a bit fun, what is a brand that has made you smile recently, Sarah?
Oh, so you warned me that you were going to ask this. And in the back of my head this whole time, I've been trying to come up with a really good, cool answer.
The Boston Globe Spotlight.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm sort of flat-footed by this.
The Red Sox. All the ones you've already said.
Oh, well, the Red Sox most certainly did not make me smile this season. So
right. True.
let's not say that one.
You know, I always put an asterisk on the smile that it can be an earnest smile, but it can also be that kind of head-shaking, woeful smile too. So feel free to interpret the smile as you please.
Okay. Well, I guess I would say, you know, this is really silly, but I am going down to – I just booked a trip to New York, so this is sort of on top of my mind. And I'm going on the train, as I always do. And I'm taking Amtrak, which is not a brand that probably makes a lot of people smile.
It makes Joe Biden smile.
It makes Joe Biden smile, and it makes me smile. I think, you know, I always love taking the train. The train between Boston and New York is especially beautiful because you go right along the Connecticut coast and it's gorgeous. But I've just, you know, that I sort of love that throwback way of traveling. So I guess that's a brand that makes me smile.
That's awesome. I wish it was more accessible. I actually, growing up, we took the Amtrak from Iowa to California, and it was a whole lot of fun. And now for us in like the middle, all of my fun friends that live in Boston can do exactly what you're doing, and I'm so envious. So your smile is a good one, because here I would have to drive to a town about an hour away called Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And get on Amtrak there. So it is not the part of my life that I wish it was. So here's hoping for better train travel and more smiles in the years to come. So if folks want to learn more about who you are and what you do, where should we tell them to go?
Well, I guess I would say go to hbr.org because, you know, I do occasionally write for the website, and I've written stuff that's there if you care to hear at this point anymore, but I have to say, but also just because we have a lot of great content on there, and I use that word that we said we weren't
gonna use. I know. Now I'm thinking about it every time I say content.
Yeah. I'd say probably hbr.org is the place to go.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Sarah, thank you for being on brand with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community, and I am going to keep it somewhat related to the Harvard family. A good friend of mine that writes frequently for the site, Heidi Grant Halverson, gave the show a shout-out on Twitter this past week, as well as looking forward to my forthcoming book. So I made that both a community shout out and a me shout out somewhat selfishly this week. But big thanks to Heidi for being a part of our community, a guest on this show, and I guess part of the HBR community as well. And jump in.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so excited you said that because I edit Heidi for HBR.
she is one of my very favorite people on all kinds of important business-related things, but also just fun, dorky superhero things too. So Heidi is good people. And a reminder, if you liked something on this episode or another, or have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, give us a holler using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. As we said, we'll link up to everything over at BrandDrivenDigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating or review, and help others find the show. Until next week. I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.